more imponderable questions. They're coming thick and fast.
Oh. First of which is, how do you undo a zip that's broken?
If Dogen talks a lot about action, and anybody who's listened to Read the Bread of Shobo Genzo, listened to my talks over the last couple of decades, I've talked about action a lot. Action being it's not a state, is it? Because it's dynamic, but we become whole. So in acting fully, we don't split the mind and the body. In other words, there's no room to think separate from moving, of being physically moving. So they all become one. And Dogen in the Shobo Genzo talks about action. Is the word we've used to translate it, gyo in Japanese. Talks about gyo butsu, which means acting Buddha. And lots of times he mentions it. So, it sounds like that must be something very important. I seem to remember talking about, you know, Zazen being a kind of action and so on. So then, what about my sitting happily doing nothing? What's that? Is that a kind of action? Sounds like it's bending the meaning of the word quite a lot, isn't it? So that's the first question. Second question is, well then, if it's not, what is it? And is it okay? Is it okay to sit and do nothing and feel content? Surely that's what it's all about, isn't it? So it occurred to me sometime last year that maybe there's a better word than action. And then I was reading some writings by Advaita teacher called Rupert Spira. Mm-hmm. He used to be a potter, so I thought he might be a good bloke. And Advaita is a teaching that came from India. In Sanskrit, it means not two. Dva, two. Advaita, not two-ness. Or not two-ism. So he was... writing very, very clearly and beautifully about the present moment and wholeness. And he used the word experiencing. And he talks rather flowery, well, not flowery, he talks in a rather mystical way of there is only experiencing. And experiencing is experiencing itself. He writes in a way that tries to deny the person, the subject. And he's very, very skillful at it. The jury's out, I haven't decided. But anyway, I like what he wrote about time very much. Experiencing, I thought, What if your is closer to experiencing? Or like being immersed in experience? I haven't found a word that captures what I want to say. So the second question is, can you find a word that will describe my happy state sitting doing nothing? You found one already?
Wonder.
Bonus point. Wonder.
Wonder.
Oh no, it's a long way from wonder to me.
See, I just, you know, I can stare at a nighttime sky and just be completely lost in it.
Ah, yes.
The amazing
okay.
Wonder of it all.
Yes, okay. Well, okay, so wonder's one possibility. You see, I understand and relate very clearly to Dogen's idea of acting from things like my rock climbing and sport and all that, and I know that when human beings act in a certain way, we can forget about me and the world and just be whole. And that's what Dogen means by gyōl. But if you think a bit, didn't know Dogen, but he was a poet. He lived in a monastery. He didn't run around doing sports all the time. Probably never even heard of yoga. He probably didn't do the cooking. So where's all his acting that he's teaching about with gyōl? But he's written some very beautiful poems, very profound, real poems. But they all suggest him sitting there, empty mind, content, and having some genius ability to put it into poetry. So maybe acting is too restrictive a word.
It's a tricky one, isn't it?
No, it's wonder doesn't cover what you do when you jump off a cliff, for example.
Is it something akin to the idea of wholeheartedness?
Wholeheartedness.
The idea that whatever you're doing, you just do it properly without being distracted by anything else.
Yes.
So if it's time to brush your teeth, you brush your teeth. It's time to climb a mountain, you climb a mountain. Time to sit and do nothing, you do that. And you just do that completely.
Yes. Oh, wholeheartedness, okay. So that's another one. Wholeheartedness.
See, I would still say that wonder captures an active observer. It's like when you watch bubbles come out of your pot and you just wonder where the next bubble's going to come from.
Ah, yeah.
There's a sense of active participation in wonder, and it's very childlike.
Yeah. But who does the wondering? The children don't. We speak about them looking at the sky and wondering what's up there, but the actual experience is likely to be they're just they're the sky.
I'm telling you, grown-ups do it.
What?
You know, I just think there's so many times where I just am staring at my coffee mixing with the milk down the side of a glass and just amazed at what's going on.
Okay, so it all boils down to being captivated by what's happening to us.
Paying attention.
That doesn't quite get to what I'm trying to say.
Yes, you can,
what about being?
Being.
Being. Being. Yeah, being is not at all dynamic, is it, as a word?
Not particularly.
See, acting is somehow dynamic.
But how fast do you have to move to act?
Well, exactly.
Is it immersion?
Immersion.
You're immersed in.
Yeah.
Immersive experiencing.
Sounds like a terrible new therapy. Sounds like a new therapy.
Could be.
Like focusing, circling. I like the word presence. That's what does it for me.
Presence.
Yeah. Even though I'm present, but like really present. Because it's just so rare that
so
I'm
it doesn't
really
doesn't matter to you using the word presence to describe a tennis player hitting the ball, and at that moment of hitting the ball, there's no tennis player, there's no ball, there's no racket, there's just oneness. Presence, does that do that?
Yeah.
Well, we each have our own understanding of the terms that we're using anyway.
Exactly.
So even if you find a word that is approximating for the majority of us, everyone is understanding something slightly different like that.
Okay, so we need a whole lexicon of words.
Does
then we need an index.
Does action always... It doesn't always... Does it always mean the action of a human being doing something with whole body and mind, or can it just mean the existence of the universe itself enacting itself? So this cup is acting, or what we're in is that. That's been my assumption, but I don't know if that's right, because you do talk a lot about body and mind being one.
Well, it's an attempt to describe an experience.
Yeah. So I always conceptualised, I'm thinking of rethinking it now, because you've raised it, but I conceptualise action or guilt as the universe itself being itself, enacting itself. You know what
okay.
I mean? So I think it's very hard for me to find a better word than action. I can see it's not.
So
it doesn't do it.
Sitting happily is acting.
Yeah.
And that's okay with people.
Can I say something? I know the character in like the kanji.
Yeah.
It. There are many, many meanings.
Yes.
You can't
as
really
with
define.
All...
Yeah. It's on its own. It can mean walking, but you can actually put it with other characters, and then it means something completely different. And it can mean.
This one.
Yeah.
That's really where the original question comes from, because I know how vague the substantive meaning of the Chinese characters can be.
Mm.
It's like mind.
Mm.
You know, there's so many Buddhist books who say the world is mind. You know, some Chinese or bloke wrote that the world is just mind.
Mm.
Well, he didn't write it was just mind, because he didn't mean mind. Because the character doesn't mean mind.
Mm.
So there's all these kind of pitfalls of translating into English, and then we're all making our own understanding, which I have no idea what you lot understand.
Well, that sounds like Wittgenstein now.
Thank you. But he tore up his first work, didn't he, and then started again. So maybe that's what I'm doing. Even more like Wittgenstein, yes. He threw away all his first Tractatus Philosophicus,
yeah,
didn't he?
He renounced it.
Renounced it.
He wrote it very early, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm still quite young. Thank you, that's a good clue.
So, just to get back to your tennis player analogy.
Yeah.
In the action where there isn't a thought about what he's about to do, he's just doing of
yes.
immediacy.
Yeah.
In the moment.
Yeah.
It doesn't draw the distinction.
No.
Between the doer and what's done, the action
yeah.
and the actor. It's just done.
Oneness, wholeness, wholeheartedness.
I'm surprised nobody's thrown in flow.
Pardon?
Flow.
Flow?
That's the psychologist's
yeah.
word. And now. So when you're sitting, you're just flowing.
If you can think non-thinking, can you act non-acting?
Yeah.
No distinction, right?
No. But anyway, I thought that Rupert Spira's term experiencing, which is very close to what you said, experience is experiencing itself. So the universe is acting. I find it a little bit not spiritual, but a little bit mystical. Like, you know, to say that the universe is drinking itself is a little bit far from picking up a cup of tea and pouring the tea down your throat. So I just...
It's not a million miles from Krishna consciousness, though, is it?
No.
So Krishna is the universe, and you are part of Krishna, and Krishna consciousness is what you're experiencing.
Yes. It's an unformed consciousness. Total pervasive consciousness. Whole awareness.
Emptiness.
There's that word. But you know, to be fair, having read a fair amount of Zen, we're a combination of very pragmatic chopping wood and mystical. So, you know, it happens in our neighborhood, right?
Chopping wood.
Being mystical and being practical. You know, being in the moment, immediate, hitting the ball, not thinking, but also being connected to everything, as Andrew was bringing up. The mystical side is there as well in that experience. You just don't have time to think about it, but you're doing it.
Okay.
Sort of thinking it in one's life, my sense is you need to have both. You need to have inaction and action. And they're not opposites exactly. It's like you have to sort of construct a rhythm in your life, kind of stopping, getting up, doing stuff, stopping, gathering yourself again. That's what I find anyway. But I think those moments when, I mean, you weren't talking about it as being anything particularly, you didn't particularly enjoy it, but in my sense of when you can just sort of sit and have a sort of moment just listening to sort of rain blowing in against the window, I think that's probably about as good as life gets on this sorry planet, really. You sort of have to do that, really.
So if it's as good as life gets, what is it?
I don't know.
Yeah, but you know, you come along and we talk about Zazen and being balanced and all that. How does it relate to all those? Or it doesn't matter? You don't have these kind of questions? What are you all doing with this stuff?
I do, but I don't bother about them at such moments. I'm not particularly that
okay.
thinking about those things.
Okay.
Sometimes I do.
But you can't conceptual. You know, we can talk forever about this.
Right.
We're never going to arrive at a term which is going to be satisfactory. You can't conceptualize what's existing. You can understand it in a different way. But you can enjoy the terminology and work within it, but you won't get to grasping reality as it is with it. I mean, I don't want to be a bum on the whole thing. That's why. Yeah. Experience isn't bad. I don't think it's better than acting. It doesn't tell me what it means.
So,
all right.
Going along with train of thought, intuition, spontaneity. You know,
I
you
think
don't,
these are all good.
You don't kill what you examine.
Yeah.
You just accept what you examine. You just spontaneously do it.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, they're all very helpful pointers, but they don't. You know, it's easy to get stuck on the ideas, isn't it? It's easy
right,
to get stuck on the objects
right.
And forget that they represent something which is
kind of hit you in the head
just
if you don't
right
catch
in front
it.
Of us, actually.
Good. So then, does experiencing kind of grab you at all?
Mm.
Well, then, are we studying Advaita, or are we? What are we studying? This bloke. Rupert Spire, he's not a Buddhist, he's not a Zen bloke, he's teaching Advaita. Is that what, maybe that's what we're teaching?
But non-duality is a big thing in Buddhism, isn't it? That's just, isn't that the same concept?
So who does it belong to then, the Buddhists or the non-dualists?
Mm. Well, they're both talking about the same thing.
I think Advaita came first, didn't it?
Chicken egg.
Advaita came first.
More the practice, like, I mean, Krishna, Advaita is part of Krishna chants and stuff, and part of Krishna teaching, but the practice that they do is very different to us.
What practice?
It's more like the practice, like, we don't go around, you know, sleeping on hard floor and dancing for 24 hours, you know, like, we don't do the ecstatic or ascetic practices, we do zazen.
We do it in our 20s.
can we do it and do zazen?
Yeah, definitely. So to me, Buddhist is just the practice, not the concept, not the state of mind, but the practice. Just we do it via zazen. That's what Buddhist. But this particular branch of Buddhism does it via zazen. Other branches of Buddhism do it in other ways. Yeah, to me, Buddhism just one of the paths to get there. Well, like, sitting, is zazen is one of the paths to get there. Sorry. That's what I mean. Alongside, you know, climbing or being ecstatic, chanting on the streets of Soho. No.
it struck me a little while ago that it's like this guy was born 2,000 years ago, or 2,000 plus, and he tried to get lots of special states, and then he kind of realized that it was okay without trying to get anything. And then he taught lots of people because they didn't realize that. It was a simple thing. It's okay as it is. And so they, it like almost sounds like they kind of said, oh yes, it is okay as it is, so let's have a box and we'll put everything he says in this box. Okay, and here's the box and the present moment, you know, and cause and effect. And there's this box, they kind of, when they got old, said, here's the box of the teachings. And then it went on and on and on, and then some clever people made replica boxes, and so, you know, there's a slightly different box went on there. And even in the present day, it's like there's this box of these teachings, and I just had this picture of, you know, if you've got a box with plants in, wooden box with plants and earth in, if you put it in the soil, up to the level, and so the soil is same inside and out, and leave it, the box rots away, and it's all one. So, I don't know whether you can get my drift, but it almost seems like Buddhism is becoming useless. Useless. because it's a box that was used to pass on teachings which perhaps were quite difficult to understand because people weren't literate, difficult to understand because people didn't understand anything about their physical bodies, difficult to understand because most people didn't have any time to practice anything but farming. But now we've got all those things. We've got time to some extent, and you know, we can meet here at a retreat centre, which they couldn't do in the 13th century. But it seems to me that the box is still around.
So do you think that the world will realise Buddhism or realise what Buddhism
Well, if it's
means?
The same inside the box and outside the box, then what's the point of the box? It's not needed anymore,
Buddhism
is it?
Will become redundant because everybody will understand Buddhism. Everyone will understand
what the
nature
what,
of reality.
What the teachings are.
Yes. And that's happening, you're saying.
Well, you see, my teacher, besides thinking he was the only person in the world who understood Buddhism, Dogen and many other things, thought that the world was moving towards Buddhism. I don't know if any of you seen that link I put to a book that I put on the web recently called Handbook of Authentic Buddhism that he wrote. And it's him. It's weird. Parts of it are really sound a bit strange if you read them, but he had this vision, and his vision was everybody would practice Zazen and everybody would be Buddhists and study Dogen. But I thought maybe his vision was right, but the picture was wrong, and maybe he might be onto something.
If Buddhism's true, then that has to happen, doesn't it? If humanity survives.
Yeah, but without the box called Buddhism.
Yeah.
So that his hope for the future will happen, but not in the way that he envisaged. Sounds like.
So what do you lose? What do you lose by the box going? What is lost?
Well, you lose Buddhist groups. Who, you know, they say we're Zen Buddhists, we're Tibetan Buddhists, we're this Buddhist, we're that Buddhist, we do this practice, we wear this colour of robes, we bow before we put the incense in the pot, blah blah blah. I don't mean to say that all this is useless or wrong. I don't mean that. I just mean simply that seems to me that maybe the outside and the inside of the box might be becoming the same. The world is understanding the teachings of the Buddha, not by reading them, not by studying Dogen or reading the Pali Sutras, but by real experience and all the other things that we have, like science and medicine and therapy and sport. And what do you think?
This sounds very similar to a guy called Stephen Batchelor.
Stephen?
He wrote a book called After Buddhism.
Yeah.
He kind of says traditional Buddhists shouldn't be elitist about meditation becoming more mainstream and people getting into mindfulness. Because we shouldn't be snooty about that, because it's actually... It's what you said, it's stuff going outside the box, and it's losing some of the kind of cultural trappings. But if it's a modern day way of people realising some of the same things, we should probably. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And his books are quite popular, aren't they?
Closing students say it'll take about 1,000 years.
I don't remember how long you said it'll take.
final stage.
So I propose that we dissolve this group.
In 1,000 years.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about millennials, but I read about millennials being very anxious and not knowing what to do and being extremely sensitive. And I wonder if that fits in with this vision, that kind of generations are seeing reality as it is, because it doesn't seem...
It's not necessarily purely linear, though.
No.
You go like that. I mean, history is messy.
Yes.
I mean, you could say that about people growing up after the Great Depression. I know.
Yeah.
My wife's grandmother for the sake of this.
Okay.
When she traveled, would steal the silverware because you just never knew. You know, it might come in handy someday.
Hmm.
And there's sort of this mentality of such scarcity. I think millennials sort of feel that they'll never buy a house. And so that contributes to sort of that level of uncertainty about their own future relative to.
So if we want to draw a trend line, we should do it through the Middle Ages and now, should we?
Before.
So it really depends on where you're measuring.
Well, we have time to reflect. I don't think the people in the Middle Ages had much time to look about.
Mm.
They didn't have much to do in the evenings.
Think about that.
Well, there have been several, massive paradigm shifts in history, and maybe we're due another one. You know.
Like an earthquake.
Huh?
Like a big earthquake.
In the way we perceive and understand ourselves in the world, yeah. And we think our way is normal, but it's really quite strange.
It's also quite kind of first world Eurocentric, isn't it? I mean, I don't think Buddhist ideas are particularly much impact in Africa or the Islamic world or the great swathes of the world's population, really.
There seems to be a lot of appreciation of Buddhist type ideas amongst nuclear physicists and people who are really involved in science, like Rupert Sheldrake and other scientists who are really looking at what is, so that they're noticing reality and being affected by what they're seeing. But that doesn't contact most of us. So
right.
There does seem to be a convergence between scientific thought and scientific practitioners and reality. But that doesn't seem to be spreading out very much from those people.
So Penrose, Roger Penrose, Oxford Math Department, has a theory of the initial moments of the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
And his current theory is called a boundary theory, which says that it doesn't go to zero. The term is singularity, so dimensions go to zero, and nobody knows what happens near the singularity. What he posits is it doesn't happen. What it goes is to a finite, small boundary, where instead of time, three dimensions in time, four dimensions, right? Time actually becomes another physical dimension. So when you get closer to the beginning of the universe, it's possible to travel left and right in what used to be called time. And it never gets to the zero point, because to have the zero point, T has to go to zero, and it doesn't. Pretty weird.
Well done, Roger. What do you think, though? You know, do we need groups anymore?
Mm-hmm. Quality control is very important. No, like, I'm serious. I have this, like, I know this guy who's a Theravadan monk. Like, he was a Theravadan monk for 15 years and he quit, and now he does some corporate trainings. And I've been to some of his retreats. He does, like, not corporate, but more like, he does this, like, men, like, Jewish men only meditation weekend retreat, which is nice. And I want to invite him to do emotional intelligence workshop for our team at work. And they told me, like, that I can't invite him because there's already a preferred supplier for emotional intelligence. Like, whom they've done due diligence on, and, like, this is, like, worked with Google, and, like, you know, like, this is the one company that we hire all this for this. So emotional intelligence, like, you can't even agree in this room what emotional intelligence or presence or experiencing is. Like, what is it that they're actually selling to you, you know? But at the same time, there's a preferred supplier, they've done due diligence on them, they have 5-star ratings, you know, like, that is important. Like, the community is important because it's some kind of reputation, you know, these people are good, these people are bad, this have this sangha, that sangha, like, I want to have some kind of bearings, and I want to be just a free-for-all,
okay.
You know?
So
that's a practical reason to have, you know, this person has been ordained this way, they've been doing it this way, okay, like, I know where they are, where to place them, at least. Otherwise, I have to spend a weekend with each one of them to find out, yeah, what they're like, I suppose. Yeah. So knowing, like, this is a Krishna person puts them in some kind of box for me. And it's easier to navigate the world if I have these abstractions rather than just everybody is a Buddhist. It's quite hard to live like that. Yeah. Oh, that's it.
Are we sure that Buddhism is going mainstream?
No.
The ideas are around, but I don't know if many more people are sitting or doing equivalent practices in other traditions.
Mm-hmm.
No.
There's lots of people in the
people doing mindfulness.
Yeah, exactly.
It's coming out of your ears, really.
Yeah, like.
Yeah.
Like in train carriage, you see like at least two people doing the mind up, whatever it's called. Yeah.
Headspace,
yeah.
Mm.
So that's a criterion then, sitting. But if Rupert Spanger can write the same thing that in a way that Dogen wrote, and he doesn't see it, then where's his access to truth coming from? For example.
Well, you can think your way to these conclusions, can't you?
Can you?
Don't know. Maybe you can.
Mm-hmm. Isn't oneness of body and mind a really common experience? I mean, it's a... Mm. It's the
is that quite modern?
Is it modern?
Mm.
I don't think it's a modern... No, I think it's the fundamental experience, but maybe in the modern world people are engaging in activities which allow them to articulate it more, perhaps?
Notice it more?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's I mean, you talked a lot about sport, haven't you? And any tennis player is fully familiar with that embodied sense of oneness. It's not anything unusual or mystical, it's just ordinary. But maybe the language is becoming more refined. And people like it, don't they? People want it.
Where are we all going? Does it feel different if I don't give you any kind of direction? Or I say things like, you don't need Buddhism anymore. Does it feel that it's kind of, ooh. Or he's lost it.
You want him to actually.
He's lost it.
No, I just think it's time for you to get busy again.
I think the benefit of being with a group is that you have a, it gives you a discipline in a way to practice and draw from other, the rest of the group's willingness to do the practice for a concerted time, you know, and it's easy, go off on your own, then you don't sit as much, then your mind goes off and you let yourself get taken away from the here and now. And just, I come here just because I know I'm going to get 3 days of concerted practice and, you know, good teachings as well. And it's like a discipline for me to come along. And then I don't have to worry about the discipline after that, because when we're all sitting in there, I've got nothing else to do. I do my best to do my sitting, and I get that practice in. And that's the benefit of the group to me.
I think groups are definitely beneficial, but per my understanding, even in countries that are normally Buddhist, where most people would call themselves Buddhist, most people don't do stuff like this. They think it's something for monks and priests. You know, they'll go to the temple on special days and stuff like that. So you're always going to have a small core of people that will really get into the practice. And then broader numbers of people who have some kind of vaguer awareness of it and maybe get something. It'll be the same in the West. There'll be people like us that appreciate the discipline, like Gaurav said. I definitely appreciate it. But if that's also other people doing something mindful in headspace, and they're not going to come and sit in a group. I don't actually know a lot about headspace, I just use that as an example, but maybe that's okay as well. Maybe there's room for both.
Because even in Buddhism, they talk about the teachings being a raft, don't they? It's the same as the box analogy. It's a means to understanding, not the actual thing that you have to keep going back over. It disappears like the box did once.
Doesn't it strike you as vaguely odd that we might be listening to a transcript of a talk by a Japanese guy who studied the writings of a 13th century monk who said, it's important to clean your teeth. It's important, you know. It's like, oh, there's something written down there. Pick up your teacup and drink your tea. Oh, I see. Doesn't it strike you as vaguely odd that we have to focus on something so far, so distant, so difficult, medieval Japanese or Tibetan or whatever, to tell us something which is here with us? Because it does me. And even some people spend their whole lives, you know. Now sit up straight. You know, I went, anybody here go with me? Last year to a workshop by Isho Fujita?
Yeah.
Oh, you went, Tom?
Yeah.
You probably noticed the same thing I noticed. Isho Fujita is a Zen monk. He's a wonderful guy. He's explaining to everybody how to sit 50 people in this dojo, all sitting on cushions and whatever, and he's explaining how to sit nicely, and they're all... it's quite incredible, really. Ah, oh, that's how you clean your teeth. It's strange, isn't it?
Well, there weren't any dentists in 13th century
Japan,
were there?
Pardon?
There weren't any dentists in 13th century
Japan. None at
all. So it's pretty serious to get tooth decay.
Yes.
You could die from it.
Yeah.
If it's a distillation of all the really important teachings, then...
Sorry?
You say, why would you do it? If it's a distillation of all the some great teachings.
Yeah.
It's presumably why you did it. Why did you do it?
I don't know, really.
Why did you... Can you think back to when you were 33 or 35?
Yeah.
Why were you doing it then? What about you?
It's interesting. Being in a Japanese temple, and when I sat, I immediately connected it with, like, my mountaineering experiences.
Very powerful.
Very powerful. Now, I don't mean that. You know, the sitting is obviously the centre of everything that we're here for. Otherwise, you'd go home, wouldn't you? Because I'm talking an hour's worth of rubbish, with no teaching or direction, and yet you're going to stay here because of the sitting together. But what about the rest of it? I don't know. I just went along and, oh, what's this about? And then carried on, and then got involved in the translation. And it kind of day followed day.
It's a vehicle for something. So it's still important, in my opinion. We can't dispense with it just yet. Or I'm not going to.
Okay.
So you watched a Robert Spira video, and now you're...
No, that's good.
Always.
No, I'm asking you questions.
The sitting is paramount. And what I learned from that, I feel, is essential. I can stop, you know. If you told me today that it's over, well, fair enough, and, you know, thank you for everything, but I'll probably keep on sitting, because it's essential.
For you.
Because I know what I was like when I wasn't. And you know,
you don't
an
know.
Intolerable twat.
That's what my teacher used to say. He used to say, I would have been a terrible person if I hadn't found Zazen. I believe him, actually.
So maybe Spirit just figured out that it's essential for him from a different starting point. He didn't have to read 13th century Zen monks to figure out that there's something valuable in being still.
Okay. It's very interesting to read, because for many years I was involved in the Shobo Genzo and studied the Shobo Genzo. I didn't read anything else, and anyway, I'm not a reader. So it's quite. I don't read many books, so it's quite interesting for me to read something. And I think, oh, he's saying the same thing. How did he get the same thing? Don't you ever feel like that?
Yeah.
How did he get to that point then?
A valid insight doesn't belong to anyone, does it? If someone else figured out non-duality and the Buddha also figured it out, that's great, isn't it?
About Jesus, did he figure it out?
Probably.
Did he?
Maybe, I don't know, mate. And the idea of the middle way, I think that crops up in more philosophies than just Buddhism as well, doesn't it?
So we're a sitting group then. Really, you don't need to say anything other than that. A Buddhist group or a Dogen group. Dogen Sanghas. Dogen Sangha, really. Just sitting group. London sitting. Yorkshire sitting. That sounds good. Mm. Yorkshire sitting.
It's the joke from pudding.
The sitting is next to the writing.
Okay, you better go and sit then.